Hello, and welcome to the Safe to Hope podcast. My name is Anne Marie, and I'm the executive director for Help Her and the host of this podcast. On the Safe to Hope, Hope Renewed in Light of Eternity podcast, we help women tell their story with an eye for God's redemptive purposes. All suffering is loss, but God leaves nothing unused in His plans. We want to help women see His redemptive thread throughout their circumstances, and then look for opportunities to join with God in His transformational work. In the Help Her ministry, we work with women in churches in multiple types of crises. So this season, we're branching out from talking about abuse to talking with a foster mom, a mother of five beautiful children, ages 6 months through 7 years. There is a common theme in our podcasts, though, and that is trauma and how it impacts families and people in a variety of ways. Caroline, our storyteller, is one woman who has both witnessed and experienced trauma in a different way. We also chose this series because foster families populate evangelical communities, so our hope is to share with the church how they can come alongside and care for the very unique needs of both the parents, the children, biological and foster children and adoptees in these families. I know you will recognize one of our expert contributors today. I know she's familiar to our Safe to Hope audience, and that is Darby Strickland. She's a frequent guest. She's a Help Her board member, which we very much appreciate. But I'd also like you to meet Jill Butler. There's going to be three of us on the podcast today. Jill is the director of operations at CCF, and she's also a counselor at CCF. And she's served in that capacity since 2021. Jill is also an online instructor for the School of Biblical Counseling, and she has a Master of Arts in Counseling from Westminster Theological Seminary. Jill's been counseling for over 12 years in the local church, as well as over 4 years in the Biblical Counseling Center, in a Biblical Counseling Center. So welcome to you both. I'm very interested to hear what we have to say today, and how well it relates to some of the things that our storyteller has been sharing with us. So just quickly, by way of reminder, on the Safe to Hope podcast, storyteller names have been changed in order to protect those associated with their stories. The Helper Ministry exists to help people in crisis and to train people helpers, so integrity is one of our greatest concerns. To the best of our ability, we have sought to honor the privacy and dignity of those who share their precious stories with us. And today, that's going to include one of our expert contributors. And I'm just going to start out with that. Jill has a very, very compelling story that I think we need to hear. And I would love if you could just tell us a little bit or a lot of who you are. Tell us about you. Tell us about your journey. Whatever you think is important.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. So my story is one that I've grown to be able to share it. It took some time for me to be able to talk about some of these things. So I want to say, as I share that today, this speaks to years of the Lord walking with me through His Spirit and just the church and friends in that. So I was born in the 80s. I was one of those crack babies that came out of that 80s epidemic. Both my biological parents, I want to say, have heartbreaking stories. There was significant abuse in their home. They both struggled with addiction and had just severe poverty in their background. I'm the only child between my biological parents. I'm the oldest of 8 children that my biological mom had. And sadly, she did lose all 8 of them to the child welfare system. I was addicted. Like I said, I was born addicted to cocaine. But I was allowed to actually go home with my birth mother that day because she had promised that she would stop using. And again, this was back in the 80s. This would not happen now. And so the first time I was removed from her, I was 3 months old. And the police report says that they were called because the baby had stopped crying. And so the neighbor was actually scared that something had happened to me. And so that was the first time I was removed. And from the time I was 3 months old until the time I was a little over five, I went back and forth between my biological mom and my adoptive family. And my adoptive family had five biological boys of their own, and they had a really difficult home. It wasn't, they struggled relationally. My parents struggled relationally. During actually the final stages of my adoption case, one of those brothers, one of their sons wrote a letter to the judge actually stating some of the abuses that were sadly going on in that home with me and with them, and asked for the adoption to not go through. And yet, again, this was the 80s. There was this family that was willing to take, by that time, a school-aged child, and there just was such a high need that there wasn't the discernment that was needed to be able to make a different choice at that time. And so, yeah, I was adopted into that family. I can remember on my adoption day, the judge calling me into his chambers and asking me which mom did I want, and just feeling overwhelmed by that question, feeling like I didn't want to have to choose at that time. Even though I had been going back and forth for 5 years, my understanding and my attachment to my biological mom was still strong. And yet I had this new relationship with my adoptive family, and just in some ways feeling like there just wasn't an easy choice. And now looking back on that, going, yeah, that's not a question I should have been asked. It wasn't a helpful question, but I think it also speaks to how the judge saw the situation. He saw a drug addicted woman who couldn't provide basic needs, and he saw an upper middle class family who was, by his assessment, able to provide the physical needs. And so it was an easy decision for him to make. And so, yeah, I was adopted. My adoptive parents still required me to spend time with what they would call was my real family, even after the adoption was done. And that was really hard and scary for me. And just even that, putting it in that framework of my real family spoke to just still the fracture that I was living out of, I think, as a little person, of realizing that there wasn't a place of security, there wasn't a place of belonging. Sadly, one of the forms of discipline in my house growing up was that I would be required to go pack a bag, is what they would just say, Jill, go pack a bag. And I had this pink 80s suitcase that all the way until I was 14, that if I was sassy or something happened that they didn't like, they would make me go and pack the bag as if they were going to give me back. So I lived with a constant state of, was I home in some way? Was I secure? When was this going to end? And just the difficulty of that relationally just impacted how I saw every relationship, not just the people who were doing it. And so just feeling really unsteady. This is where I have to say the Lord was so gracious to me in providing me teachers who knew the Lord, and they cared for me. I became a Christian in junior high, and the church knew that I wasn't safe at home, but they didn't know why. I wasn't someone who spoke about what was going on at home. I knew pretty quickly that what my home looked like wasn't what other people's houses looked like. And so what I learned, I learned this going back and forth in foster care too, of going, if I speak about what's going on at home, that's going to change where I sleep that night. That's going to change who I call mom the next day. That's going to change where I go to school the next day. And so though everyone was telling me to speak, the consequences of me speaking were actually bringing about things that felt very out of control to me. And I didn't always agree with what the consequence of me speaking would mean. And so I just learned not to tell my story, actually. I learned not to talk about it. I learned to either literally not speak when someone asked me a specific question, or give them some sort of vague answer that I think they really wanted to hear, because it would get me out of having to actually talk about the things that were going on. And so my, like I said, my church provided I had a really phenomenal youth pastor. And I remember him saying to me, after many times of him asking me what's going on, or Jill, something's not right. Or he saw that by just different behaviors or places where I withdrew. And I really didn't answer him. And so one day he sat me down and he said, Jill, I know something's not right at home, but I don't know what it is. Will you tell me? And I didn't speak. And so after a long enough awkward silence, he said, I don't know what it is, but we're going to give you a safe place to go every night. And so the church came alongside and had, on Monday night, I would go to this family's house. On Tuesday night, I would go to this family's house. And literally Sunday through Saturday, they provided three or four families between the week that if something happened, or if I wasn't doing well, that I could just show up at their house, that there wouldn't be questions asked, that this family would just care for me. And that's what these families really did. It didn't happen every week, but it did happen on occasion. And these families, I played sports all the way through high school. My family never came to like practices or games or anything like that. I was lucky enough to actually be able to go to our districts and even to state. And the two of these families ended up coming and supporting me in that. And that was just one of the ways that as I look back in my story, I'm able to see how the Lord's hand was always there in a place of provision, even if it didn't come in the way that I would have wanted or desired or had hoped for. So I would say fast forward, just even a few years ago, now I was visiting my adoptive dad, and we've had a very complicated relationship from the time that I was adopted. He worked a lot. My mom was very abusive to all of us children, and my dad just was very passive in that. He would he traveled a lot for work. He was very, very successful in his job, and how he managed the home was just passivity and escape. And so we've had seasons where we didn't speak, and we're currently in a season to where we do have a relationship. And I had gone home to see him and his new wife. My mom has passed away 8 years ago now. And he brought out this huge briefcase full of all of my adoption paperwork. My social worker had been decent friends with my parents, and she had made copies of everything that would have been in my file. So it had all the police reports, it had hospital stays, it had interviews between both my biological parents, some people in their family, on why they were not choosing to adopt me, why they wouldn't choose to be placements for me. And he gave it to me and he said, Jill, I just think it's time for you to know what really happened to you. I know a lot of this happened to you before you could remember. And in that conversation, he also just expressed regret for adopting me. And not in a way that was helpful, in a way that was just really in some ways breaking parts that already felt very broken. And it took me a few, like I think 2 months, to really be able to sit in front of someone and tell someone that that had even happened. All these years later, where I know so much more truth, but because of just how heartbreaking that was, of in some ways affirming things that I had already either assumed to be true or had been told to be true, but knowing and feeling that in that moment, as where the place that I was at in my own story, and being able to have to hear from him, no, we shouldn't have done this. I regret doing it, and it didn't really work out well for anyone. I think my dad said that from a place of like wanting like relief from his conscience, not understanding that even as a 30 plus year old woman, then I still just wanted a dad. Mm. like that I was still just having to come to terms with, okay, like I don't have a dad. And so that I, one of the things I often tell people that I work with is we don't outlive our story. We're always, my story from, yeah, when I was young to now, I'm still living that and will live that until, yeah, the Lord takes me home and helps me know it from his perspective. Clearly, I get to know pieces of that now, but I don't get to know it fully. And so, yeah, just even in that, there wasn't, I have had counseling, I've had dear friends, I've had good churches, I've had the supports that the Lord has brought into my life to help me be able to sift through my story. But even in that, to hear that from him that day, yeah, it was shaping. And it brought me back in some ways to ground zero and for places that I had to trust the Lord to be faithful again to me and how I think about that. So yeah, that's a bit about what's going on and where I am and how he's provided.
Wow. Even having heard it before, hearing it again, it just still impacts me. My inner being cries out for that little girl.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Me too. I think it's one of those things when I have to remind myself of going, you know, Jill, it's okay for that to still be tender to the touch. And it is. There's times where, you know, thinking about that, the pain of it will take my breath away. And then there's times where thinking about it, I just look at it and go like, Lord, I can't believe all that you've done. Mm. And that it really, that experience is a bit of a seesaw. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the one isn't steady in that. Both of those things happen at the same time often.
And I think that's just such important, precious truths, right? It's just to have the grief and the hope simultaneously going back and forth. And just explaining that journey for so many people who are experiencing that similar pull in both, two things have to be true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 And the percentages of the emotion of them can shift, but the reality of both of them are always consistent to me. Mm-hmm. And what I see other people have to live out of too in heartbreaking in situations. So
it's sweet to see too, like even just how you can see at this vantage point, the Lord's hand, mm-hmm. right? I think that's one thing Anne-Marie's always drawing out is that redemptive thread. And she talks about story as story work, right? It's just so clear that you've done the work to be able to see the thread and that has been costly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I sometimes will joke, I've paid a lot of money to be able to say these things. So I need to actually be able to say them because it is work to be able to sit here and be able to speak those things and feel the heartbreak of them. And have the wrestle of going, even in my own internal world right now, where I have to go, there were times when even saying that now, I have to say, Jill, that wasn't your fault. Mm-hmm. Because I can logically know that, right? I did child welfare. I was a child welfare social worker for a few years. I sit with other people and I get paid to tell people things are not their fault. and yet when I'm having to listen to my own narration of my own story, I can quickly go into the ditch of, but if I would have, if only I had done this, and yeah, just have to trust that's in the Lord's sovereignty in that, and then being able to look back on it now and be able to see, yeah, just I know oftentimes like public schools get a lot of, you know, flack, and they do a lot. There's a lot of struggle in that right now. I don't know if I would physically be alive if it wasn't for the public school system. Like the reality of that, the reality of their care and their protection and their provision for me. Like that was my need was met there. And then the Lord in his abundance and grace put, I know my first through fourth grade teachers knew the Lord. And I can remember, I didn't know the Lord then, but I remember Bible verses. I remember them saying, talking about him. and just seeing back of going, like, even then, in a very non-church setting, he was planting seeds for his redemption in my story.
I think that's, to me, that's what's standing out to me as an outsider listening is how the church, different people in the church body, and then the church as a whole, really rescued you in key ways, even though the system was failing you, right? It was, like, yeah. But individuals were not, because they understood what it was to care for a vulnerable person.
Yeah. And they could see true things about me that I couldn't see, you know, as a little kid, like you don't see what's really happening to you. And especially when that's all you've ever known. Right. I remember when I first started really telling my story, one of my very best friends, I lived with her family for actually 5 years, and it was just so redemptive and helpful to me. But I remember the first time I started telling her my story, and she broke down crying in places that felt just weird to me. And it was that realization of going, in some ways, she knew my loss in ways I didn't. I've never had a mother or a father who has known me and loved me. She has never known a day without it. So she knows a level of my loss that I actually, by God's protection, I don't know that. Now, do I wish I knew it? Do I have the loss of even that loss? Absolutely. But she knows a level of my loss. And because of that, can speak to me in ways that says, no, Jill, this is how you're supposed to be cared for. This is what you missed out on. This is who God says he is. This is who God says parents are supposed to be. This is how I experienced it. And that was just a real pivotal moment for me of one, realizing the mercy in some ways of not knowing what I was losing at that age, and the heartbreak of now knowing what I don't have, and how has the Lord met some of those needs now.
Wow. I have so many questions I really want to ask, I guess, but I need to kind of focus in. I appreciate so much just having this other perspective. Our storyteller is, they have a loving family with the foster children in their home. But that's not always the case, obviously. And you're describing it very, very well for us, the inside perspective from the child.
I think one thing I'm appreciating about listening to Caroline's story is her willingness to step into the unknown. Right, we're hearing from Jill where there weren't Christians and people who had a mission on their heart at that time to come around her. And Caroline's children have a different outcome because they are people that are seeking to love well, and her foster children and adoptive children for Jesus. And I think it just highlights the need that the church can meet in many beautiful ways that we've seen in her story.
Right. Right. You know, Darby, I'm going to ask you a question. You have talked about, I believe I read it even in your little booklet on trauma. You say that you realized at a certain point that you were called by God as an under shepherd for your children. Mm. And I think that's a really great term, and one that's going to apply really well here with talking about foster and adoptive families. So as adults in our children's lives, biological or by way of welcoming foster or adoptive children into our homes, we are privileged to shepherd them toward handling life's problems and joys, as Jill's talking about there too, and growing into maturity and Christlikeness. And that calling is the same for both biological parents and the adoptive parents. But one thing we know for sure, and what we're hearing from Jill, is that they also suffer great loss. And I'll circle back to you on this one, Jill, because I want to hear your thoughts on the brokenness. But Darby, what are some of the ways as a parent that you've learned, as an under-shepherd, that you've learned to steward a child's heart in healing?
I think the first little bit is just remembering that I am an under-shepherd, right? We hear Jill's story and our heart is immediately overwhelmed. And we hear Caroline's story and our hearts are just so overwhelmed for the responsibility that showed up at her doorstep. And I think as someone who we want people to care for the vulnerable and the very broken, we have to remind them they're not doing that alone, that they have help, that they have not just help through the Lord through prayer, but through help through his community of believers that he provides in all sorts of ways. So I think it's just one is remembering it's not all up to us. A lot of these problems we cannot solve, right? I think we've even heard that in Caroline's story and in Jill's. There's just outcomes and things that are unpredictable and courts and rulings that don't make sense to us. But the Lord is always over everyone's story. And I think that just gives us the courage to walk through hard things with our children, knowing that it's not all up to us, that we have a helper. And we have someone who actually loves our children more than we ever can imagine. I just feel like that's a very comforting and orienting truth. The other thing is just to remember that what we're doing is very purposeful, right? It's we're doing so much more than sheltering and feeding and educating a child. We actually are helping shape their interpretations of the world and the Lord's care for them and what love should look like. And so shepherding is just a helpful word because it talks about like our shaping influences. Like our job is to walk with our children through the valleys and bring them out and keep them safe and to guard them and provide them good teaching and places of rest. So I think it just creates a metaphor, a beautiful picture of all that's involved in parenting. And so it helps us to slow down and really think about how is my child's heart? What does their heart need from me? Where's their heart wrestling with? What are they not understanding about their world? And again, how can I gently come alongside them and bring them out of those really hard places? And I'm not dragging them, right? A shepherd walks alongside, walks with, often carries. And so I just think it speaks to the amount of nurturing we have to do.
Yeah, that's good. That's really good. And so, Jill, you talked about the losses that you didn't even know you had. I think I've heard you talk about this before, of course, the brokenness and how the church should probably think more or differently about adoptees, about adoption. I'll just let you speak to that.
Yeah, that's helpful. I think, I was even last week in a counseling session with a couple who've been struggling with infertility. And the husband sheepishly says, we don't know what we think about adoption. And I could tell he doesn't know a significant part of my story. I don't even think they know that I'm adopted. And I just remember looking at him going, adoption's not the answer to infertility. And the wife gets immediately emotional and says, but that's what the church tells us. Like, that's actually what people tell us. That's what our, if we are struggling with infertility, then we, this needs to be one of the very first things that we pursue. And I think that became an answer to infertility in a way, as we've seen infertility have more people in the church struggle with that. And I've watched it just compound struggle, just makes harder things harder. When we take brokenness and add brokenness on top of brokenness, when the brokenness isn't Christ, right? And that there is real brokenness in stories. I think we see that in Carolina. They're inviting brokenness into their home. They're inviting hardship into their home and hurt in that. And so I would say, I would just be very cautious in how, what we think about adoption, what we think about, where we would say, yes, the Lord absolutely gives a biblical mandate. We must care for widows and orphans, but there's so many ways to do that. Like it doesn't have to be adoption. Just like, Caroline talked about, I've experienced too of people willing to walk alongside families who are adopting, or how do you help maybe kids stay in homes where there isn't the resources, whether that's emotional or physical, that there's plenty of other ways, to look at the orphan than adoption. Adoption isn't the only answer for kids who are in broken situations. I think the other thing that I would say, one of the things that I often will say, and I think this fits for anyone who had severe childhood trauma. I don't think it just has it doesn't just fit for adoption. But one of the things that I'll say is I feel like I've had to live my life backwards. At 5 years old, I knew how to make them. I knew how to feed myself and my biological younger siblings. I knew how to pull the chair over to the microwave. I knew how to how to make the mac and cheese. I knew how to use a can opener and put the food in there and just make sure that we were able to survive, right? I knew how to lock the doors. I knew, in many ways, when I was in my biological setting, I was the child-headed household, right? Like we hear about that in other countries, but the reality of it is we have child-headed households here. As well. And so I learned how to be responsible to a place of being that adult, right? I learned how in some ways to manipulate what information people knew and all of that. And now as an adult, I have to learn what it means to be cared for. I have to learn what it means that, you know what, just because I can doesn't mean I should. I have to learn what it means to be able to speak from a heart that is full of all kinds of complicated emotions and not have to have those things figured out before they come out of my mouth, because otherwise they'll never actually come out of my mouth. And so I think when you have that level of brokenness in a child, when they are a child, I think like what Darby's basically saying is know them and trust that there's more to know about them than what they see, than what you see, right? Because that's what the Lord tells us is true of us, no matter our age. And I think oftentimes we can be more dismissive of that in a child because they're smaller and you're more concerned about like what I find parents are is they look at their 4-year-old and they see a 20-year-old. They don't want their 20-year-old to talk like that or do that or hit that or bite that, right? But do you look at them and see them as the 4-year-old? Because that's how the Lord looks at me. Like the Lord looks at me and sees what parts of my heart are still very much a 4-year-old and what parts of my heart are now a 40-year-old, right? And so to have that vantage point or to know that vantage point exists for the child. And yeah, I would say for the church, like you probably have a lot of people in your life living life backwards, right? There's people who are required to be adults at very young ages, or at least bear the weight of adult responsibility that now, you know, the Lord's trying to teach them, what does it mean to be his child? What does it mean to be, weak and limited and just human in that.
Throughout this series, we'll be talking about foster and adoptive caregiving and how the church can partner with families who've taken on this calling. Our storyteller will mention several times that the goal of fostering is not adoption, but reunification. Yet, in North Carolina foster care, a child has only a 42% chance of reunifying with their parent and faces an average stay in the system of about 20 months. So, considering reunification as the goal, what does it look like for the church to come alongside families? Well, coincidentally, you'll hear me talk in our podcast series about a ministry by that very name. Alongside Families is a really innovative and wise approach that a church might easily consider adopting into their own local church. My friend Michelle represents Alongside Families in her church, so I've asked her to talk with me briefly about this ministry. Welcome, Michelle, and could you just paint a picture of Alongside Families?
Thank you, Anne Marie. Just imagine for a minute being a single mother who needs emergency medical care, but who has no friends or family to lean on for support. Imagine if your child had to be removed from your custody into the foster care system simply because there was no alternative when you needed to be hospitalized. Alongside Families believes that families belong together and that the local church has the power to make that happen. Alongside Families equips volunteer host families in partner churches to temporarily care for children while a parent gets back on their feet. In approaching care in this way, we prevent children from unnecessarily entering foster care when abuse and neglect haven't occurred, and provide a dignifying way for parents to ask for and to get help when they need it.
Yeah, I think that's just genius. and also alongside families really does demonstrate a similar heart for women in crises as the Helper Ministry. So we're happy to share this option for the local church to consider. And Michelle, can you just share some statistics for the outcome when families are cared for through Alongside?
Well, our average hosting length is 20 days, and we have reunified 100% of children with their parents.
Unbelievable. 20 days versus 20 months, and also 100%. That's pretty impressive. How can a church get involved with Alongside families?
As a church-led, privately funded ministry, we're always looking for gospel-centered churches and donors to fuel this ministry of family preservation. If you want to learn more, you can visit us at alongsidefamilies.org. If you don't live in North Carolina, check out upstreamcollab.org to find a collaborative of similar ministries championing gospel-centered family preservation across the United States.
Wonderful. Thank you, Michelle. And we'll be sure to include these links in our show notes. I think Caroline said it often. I don't know if she said it in this session that we're interacting basically on, that adoption is not the answer, as you're saying. And she talks a lot about the brokenness. I'm just going to play this one part that she talked about with the trauma. And then I have a question for both of you, if you will.
But I think just when you are living with someone who has experienced trauma, especially a child who developmentally does not have the capacity to think through some of the things that they've experienced and honestly just things they never should have experienced, it can really look like and can feel like that trauma wins. There are many nights and days and phone calls that I've left or just gone to bed feeling like trauma has won, and asking the Lord, why does it feel like it's always winning? And even though I know the end of the story, it doesn't always feel like I do.
Okay, yeah, kind of repeating what you're saying, but from the mom perspective of the family, right? But what I'd like to know from both of you is, from the perspective of the child, Joe, and also from this perspective of a counselor, if you want to, and Darby, from the perspective of the counselor, how do we use the stories of Scripture, connect them to our stories of trauma, and then how does that impact the feelings she's talking about? Like, it doesn't look like anything's going to, you know, end up well, even though I know the end of the story. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think like we see that in Jesus as he's heading to the cross. He knows the end of the story. He's actually been there. He's right. He's been with God. He knows where he's going. He knows the purpose of his death is to save all the people who are on his heart. And he still sweats blood. Mm-hmm. He's still in agony. He's hanging on the cross and questioning his Father's care for him. So if Jesus, facing great suffering, knowing the purpose, is still in anguish, it's okay to be in anguish. We need to articulate the anguish. We need to share the anguish. And yet the same Jesus enters in and meets us exactly where we are. So we know the end of the story, but we don't ever have to rush to the end of the story. We have to help people live in the moment. So when you have a four-year-old who you're taking to church and is refusing to go into the nursery because they don't know who they can trust, because life has taught them that people are not worthy of their trust, right? We don't rush them through, you need to trust people. We say, no, we understand that you have been harmed by people. And so how do we help you in this very moment? And that's often by offering comfort and reassurance and not requiring of things that that cause them anxiety initially. Mm-hmm.
I think that's really good. I think it's that, yeah, I think we have to be more patient with ourselves, whether you are the, no matter what role you are in the story of any brokenness, but in this especially, of going, there is the, there's just that reality that Darby's just talking about of going, yeah, you're not going to not have the emotion. There is the faith that doesn't anesthetize that, David would say. And so I think for, as I thought about it too, of going, where does Scripture actually make sense to me? One of the verses that's been so helpful to me, and it's a little surprising, probably is that Isaiah 49:15, and it says, "Can a mother forget her child?" Right, and then he goes on to say, "Even then, I will not forget you." And the reality of it is we have a lot of people who have the story. Their story is in the even then. Right? Everyone's story gets to be known in that, because there are some people who go, a mother could never forget her child, right? As a mother's heart, you go, I would never forget my child. But the Lord knows that there are some that don't have a mother, that because of the wickedness of this world, that has been withheld from them. And so he gives them the words, even then. And then he gives himself. I will not forget you. And it's that place. One of the things we've been talking about recently, because Dara B's been bringing it to our attention, is just our union with Christ. It is in that even then that I actually have my union with Christ, that he has come, he has sought, he has captured me. And yeah, Christ himself spent time with the Father in true abandonment. So I would never know a day without a Father. And if I can take that back, if I can go back to the road of Calvary and go, okay, he actually knows the fullness of abandonment. And I just have a taste, so that way I will actually never know it completely. And there will be a day where it will never touch me again. Then that's the direction I need to go. And that I may go that way with tears. I may go that way with fury. I may go that way in isolation, but that's the direction that I am promised. And in some ways, it's not even up to me anymore. He's going to take me there. And that is what I have to trust in. But also be very patient with myself or with others and go, and you get to have the fury. You get to have the devastation. You get Christ, like Darby was saying, was so anxious. He sweat blood. Like, I've never known a day that full of anxiety, if I'm honest. But I've known heartache that caused actually that.
I hear the title of your book. Even then. No, that's good. And just bouncing off of what we're talking about here. So let's say in the home, this is not addressed. The 4-year-old's made to go to nursery, and she or he is living in the even then. What are the long-term impacts of ignoring this kind of trauma in their lives, or dismissing it, or just not addressing it?
Right. I think that's just speaking practically, right? Of having been a mother of young children, we like order. We don't like chaos. And children's behavior often stands in the way. It disrupts, right? It makes us look bad. It's uncomfortable. And so we can be tempted to, when we're taking traumatized children in our home, to create the order and require behavior and performance and not address the heart, right? I think that's what you're asking about. We would hope that by and large, all of us would slow down and address the heart. And we're, none of us are going to do that perfectly, right? But we're hoping that's at least on our map of parenting. But for the children whose childhood trauma is not addressed, it's not on the parental map, that they are missing tending to the child's cues. A lot of long-term effects can happen when a child's heart isn't cared for. They can be health concerns. They can really affect them as adults, their health. It really affects the way that their ability to trust other people, their ability to concentrate in school. There's just a plethora, it affects their whole person, body and soul. I think that even just highlights what is going on is so important that we slow down and attend to it, because the impacts will actually get worse for them over time if they aren't given a place to heal.
I would say, like Darby's saying, every parent struggles with that. One of the sweetest gifts you can give your kids as a parent is an apology. Mm-hmm. Right, is for you to even now, if you hear this and feel convicted of like, oh shoot, I actually did that, to just go to them and say, you remember when mama did that? I'm sorry. I didn't see you, and I wanna be able to see you. I wanna know you. I want you to I want to care well for you, even at the cost of my reputation, even at the cost of my comfort, even at the cost of my convenience. And I didn't do that. So I'm sorry. You know, I think being able to go back and because every parent has to do that. whether you have an adopted kid in your house or not, let me give you a spoiler. you have to be willing to say, I didn't see you as I wanted to, and as I could have. Mm-hmm. And so,
I think a relatable point for that for all caregivers is trying to put a child to bed who's anxious, who's having bad dreams, right? You're not going to be able to discipline fear out of a child. Mm-mm. Right? It's like you have to tend to their fears. And that's just something common to all of us, right? There might be a point that becomes defiance or manipulation, but if it's truly a child is fearful, right? Discipline is not going to help the child go to sleep, right? And so we all experience those moments as parents. It's common to us all. But I think that's transferable onto situations where now a child is coming out of something, a history that's very difficult, something very disruptive, maybe distressing and harmful in their lives and being put in a new family. That type of situation is going to create all sorts of fear and anxiety. And so it just requires we look at lots of moments with a broader lens. And I think that's where it's helpful to have other people in the church come alongside, because that's exhausting as a parent. Mm-hmm. You need a break from that. You need people to encourage you. You need people to brainstorm with you creative ways to carry the load with you, to show up with a coffee, to be praying for you, to be able to sustain what you are doing. Because you cannot do that, and you cannot parent that way in your own strength.
Yeah, very much. Very much so. We're touching on it, but just to be more directed in a question, how does this kind of care, how is it an opportunity?
Well, I think it's an opportunity for you to know the Lord, right? And for the parent to know the Lord as much and be able to genuinely go, oh, this is the grace and mercy I receive. The Lord doesn't wake me up every day and let me know all the ways I've disappointed his statutes, or I'm not doing well, or all of my sins against me, right? Like the mercy of Christ, the mercies that meet me every morning, some of them are the fact that I don't have to pay the consequence for every single wrong thing that I'm going to do that day, right? Because he's going to know me, and he's going to know where I am in the process of my story. And the opportunity is for you to then embody that, I think, to the person in front of you that you're literally laying down your life for.
Yeah, I think too, like a body of believers, we heard in Caroline's story, right? The church ministries director, she saw things, she saw a need, she got educated. In Jill's story, like her pastor saw something wasn't right, and he got creative and he enlisted an army of caregivers. And so I think it's, again, if we're slowing down in all our relationships, we're saying, if the Lord's put somebody in my path, is he asking me to take part in their story? How is he asking me to serve? What do I need to learn and understand? Again, I'm curious, I'm moving in, and I'm choosing to love in ways that I initially probably don't know how to do, but I'm going to learn how to do.
I think the other thing that I would say in that too is, if you know one story, you know one story. You know, I think Caroline did a phenomenal job of speaking to what I hear be consistent themes through stories. My story that I shared today has some themes that are consistent in adoptee stories, but it's still just one story. And so part of being educated, I think, is knowing themes and then knowing intimately the truth of that person's story, right? Because I have dear friends who have a beautiful adoption story, you know, and the Lord, it looks very different for them. They don't have some of the complex things that are in mind, or they don't have a desire to know more about biological families. Like, genuinely, that's just not what the Lord has stirred in their hearts. And so to be able to give permission for every story to be different, even within an adoptee or an adoptive family story, the things that are going to work out out, and that family is going to look very different based on each family. And so I think giving people permission for their story to be unique is helpful.
And Caroline did, I asked her that question about her storytelling. Mm-hmm. I'm going to play that, what she said, and then I have a question again.
I think there's definitely caution in sharing our stories first, because you just never know what someone else is going through. And so, I think just always just having discernment on when to share your story and who to share your story with is something to think through. And then knowing that the point in storytelling is not to make, not make people feel bad for you or even really for others to feel what you're feeling, but it's a way to be more understood. And as a believer, it really is to bring Christ's glory.
So you were just talking about it, Jill, but you also, when you were telling your story, talking about how you couldn't tell your story to your church leaders. So help me, again, both of you, please chime in, but help me understand, help our audience understand what kinds of things would be helpful as leaders, counselors, whoever, to help somebody prepare to be able to tell that story. I mean, you sat there in silence when you were directly asked. Is there anything that you can help us understand that would have been helpful?
Yeah, I think it spoke to where I was at. And to be honest, it spoke to my lack of safety of where I was at. It would not have been safe for me in some ways to speak at that time. And so I would say it's that part where you get to embody the long suffering of that. I think also there is a place of going, is there a way to get the story out? Can you write? Could you put even in a paragraph? Could you journal? Are there places where you can get the internal, external? Because that's really helpful. And the Lord asks us to do that. And so I would say, and be careful. I would also say if you're the helper in that situation, just if you're starting to feel exasperated or you're starting to feel, just frustrated, I would just ask you to say, where is that coming from? And who is that really about? Is it about you feeling as the helper? There's times where I can feel this too, where I feel either like I'm not doing a good job or I'm inefficient, or if I was better at this, I would be able to draw the person out more quickly. It could just be the reality of where the person is at with their story. And so, yeah, I say all of that to be patient with them. I think the thing that I do sort of want to speak to as well is to the person who is speaking or needing to tell their story. I would say, I think we need to be careful to not idolize our story. And I watch one of the ways that we do this is somebody has to know what I've been through. They have to have experienced it in order to like know me or to be a help to me. And if I'm honest, I don't want anyone I know. I don't want anyone to have to have experienced some of the things I've experienced in my life. Like I don't want that to be true for anyone. And yet I still do really want to be known. And so when I look at my story and I look at the suffering and the brokenness that has happened, I want that to produce a generosity of spirit in me and an understanding of me and suffering that can walk with someone else that doesn't necessarily have to have my same specifics, but they know what it's like to go, Lord, where are you? Or Lord, why did this have to happen this way? Or why are you withholding? I have a dear friend who they lost their child when she was 3 months old. And the way that we've been able to just sit with each other and with the Lord and say, this doesn't make sense and it's not fair and it's not right, and have those places of just heartache together, I would have lost if I would have said, you know what? She can't know what pain looks like because she didn't have abandonment at this age, or she didn't have parents who did this to her. And so I would just say, I think for the person who is in the place of grief, I would just encourage you to go, is my suffering giving me a generosity of spirit to other people suffering? I also do, like, I know you've had Jonathan before. He is a dear friend of me. There's times where we can just send each other a text, and we can send each other five words that, like, help us know, like, no, you get it. So I don't want to undersell what that means to feel like someone walks, you know, someone has an idea or an similar experience. But I watch that oftentimes be told of going, well, you know, this was helpful because this person, or you can't help because you don't know, you know, or they'll, yeah, adoptive kids will say to me like, oh, well, you can help me because you know. There's some truth to that, but that's not the whole truth. And that's not what I would say. What suffering should be producing in us, if that makes sense.
Very much so. And I think the idolize is the right word. I don't have the trauma you have, that Darby doesn't have, that, you know, that whoever else doesn't have, but I think empathy is what helps me listen to you and listen with ears to hear what you're not saying even. And I think that was something that you said at the beginning of that section was, what wasn't said was that you were not in a safe place. And yet your pastor, I believe you said it was, heard that. Mm-hmm. In what wasn't said. And that takes that's a real skill in listening, and a practiced skill, I think. But I don't know, Darby, were you going to say anything?
No, I think that's really important, right? Stories can't be told until there's safety and stability, right? And so, right, taking this back in two directions is recognizing children moving into foster care, their world isn't stable for a while. Right. And so it's just even recognizing the amount of patience for that and thinking about the parental responsibility. Right. As I'll answer in the other direction, which I think Caroline did a good job with, is it's not her story. Her story is in the caretaking of them, but she's not sharing the details of their hurts and wounds and abandonment because that shouldn't be public. Right. That it's already enough that it's in a child's file. Right? But it shouldn't be fodder for the community what a child has endured. And I think of Jesus going to heal Jairus's daughter, right? She's dead. And there's a sweet moment where, you know, there's all these people and he takes only his closest disciples in with him and the parents. And he brings her back to life. He holds her hand. And just, it's so tender and gentle. And his concern is so clearly for the child. This isn't a miracle for the public consumption. This is for her, right? And so there aren't people there watching, as if in his case of his other miracles, right? She was a young person. And he even says as he leaves, I strictly forbid you to speak about this, because it was about caring for her as a child in her capacity. I mean, imagine being raised to life with an audience, right? It would be so different. And I think we can just transfer that on to these children. Their story should not be public. Yes, please support my child. They're struggling with, you know, fear of rejection, sure, themes, but those details. And I just think we also have to be careful. And I'm not saying you don't have a good friend that you're confiding those things in, but there is that discernment of who, whether I'm adult or I'm a parent of a child or I'm that child growing up, who can be really trusted with these things, because they're precious and they need wise care of someone who's going to treasure and protect my story. And I just think that's really important in this area to recognize, especially in our social media world. I see it all the time. The picture of a mom posting a child in the ER crying and completely distraught. You know, this is my night. And I'm thinking, no, this is your child's night. Mm-hmm. Right. And so we're not geared to think as parents about protecting our child in that way. But I could hear that really well in Caroline. So I just think that was just another thing to, but what does that mean? That costs her something greatly, because then when she's in Bible study, people don't really know her in the way that she wants to be known. And so there's that tension, right? That she needs to be known, but she has to really curate where she's fully known. So I'm just trying to point out some of those tension points as people who walk alongside and be willing to love knowing less. Be willing to say there's something else here I don't understand. So I'm gonna bend down to serve, and not explain away what I don't understand. So yeah, I just think the conversation today has just really highlighted for me all the complexities and the layers of wisdom and the tenderness involved. And just there's so many different people in this story. Yeah, I just wanted to highlight some of those things as I'm sitting thinking, reflecting even on Jill's story. Like, I'm sure that pastor's families that came around side her were wise, right? They weren't, she wasn't, she felt loved by them, not talked about by them.
Right. It doesn't turn into the gossip, or it doesn't turn into, we would never call it that, but they're like, what do you know? Right. Like, the, right. How close are you? You know, mm-hmm. where the competitiveness of relationship, especially when in church communities of, you know, somebody, everyone wants to be the helper. And yeah, that there can become a bit there, I think, really, too, what Darby has talked about. And I think this is a constant theme of this podcast, is just the dignity aspect. Mm-hmm. Like, we allow people to have, even in places of great shame and despair, that there's still a dignity that we want to allow and foster and give. And yeah, even in how I talk about my story today, like my dad is still living. I need, my adoptive dad is still living. Both my biological parents are still living. Like, I need to be careful, and I want, because even though, it's my story, I'm not the only person in my story of that. And so wanting to even talk about those things in a way that is charitable to them, knowing that there's hardships in their stories that have created the hardships in mine, that there are places in that. I think the other thing that I would, there's two other things that I think I would say quickly is, one is, I think oftentimes I can remember and still at times do, I will piecemeal my story because it feels like such a burden. I know it's a burden to me. And I know if I were to go through of all of the things that had happened, that is a heavy weight. And so I don't just have to carry that weight. I now have to carry the response of that weight to another person. And that can feel overwhelming. I love my people. I don't want them to hurt. And I don't want them to have to hurt for me. But I need them to hurt for me. And so I think the other thing is, be careful with the fact that the story is going to come out in pieces. And don't feel like that speaks actually to trust, and it speaks to growth and long suffering. Don't expect the story to all come out at one time. And I would say the other thing that I would really love the church to know is, it's okay, or I feel like there's times where well-meaning people will say or will do things that will try to compensate for the Lord saying no. To this day, the Lord has said no. I don't get a mom and a dad. Do I get a church family that loves me and cares about me? Absolutely. Do I have one place that I know I should go to on Christmas, Easter, and Thanksgiving? No, the Lord has said no. Do I have 22 places I could go to on Christmas, Easter, and Thanksgiving? Yeah. And you know what? That's a heartache. It's a heartache to not have a place. It's a discernment issue sometimes and how to have to pick that. But I think sometimes what the church will come in and well-meaning people will do, they will be so uncomfortable with the fact that the Lord is saying no, that they'll say, oh no, now this is your place. We are your place. We are, you know, that they'll try to compensate for places where the Lord has said no. And I think we just have to be okay with that fact that sometimes we have a God who is a father who tells us no. And if we try to compensate for that,
bypass the suffering is what you're trying to say there.
And it can create unhealthy codependent relationships. It can create places where it makes healing go stagnant. So I think that's the other thing that I would say to a church leader is, are you trying to say yes in some place the Lord is saying no? That doesn't mean you don't care. It doesn't mean you don't move towards. It doesn't mean that you don't, make sure adoptive families have people that are going to walk alongside them, that adopted kids are going to have people that know them. Absolutely. That's the call of the church. But not to compensate or to make up for something that the Lord has said no to.
That is an excellent word to hear. Yeah. Is there any other question or something burning on your heart that you think should be said that hasn't been yet?
I think the other thing I would say is whenever I meet, I want to be careful. Whenever I meet an adopted family or a foster family, I always just want to say thank you. I have no idea how well they're doing or what that is, but I'm so, so grateful that people are willing to listen to the Lord say, an orphan really needs you. And I'm so thankful, whether it's the actual family who's providing that immediate need or the families that are walking next to them, that there are stories where the Lord provides that, because he is a good provider of that. And I can look at it now and say it helps me understand in the places where I have to deal with loss that it was not designed to be that way. That the loss is actually goes against the way that the Lord designed it to be. And so to be able to look at foster families and adoptive families and just say, thank you. Like, thank you for caring for people. Thank you for being willing to hold more than one story in your home. Because really, there's always, in that level of brokenness, both the family and the children have to hold two storylines in one heart often when it comes to adoption and foster care. And that's a weighty thing that produces much joy and suffering.
Yeah. And both those things can be true at the same time. Well, thank you both, for giving, speaking of saying thank you, you're giving as well, in a way that I think is just rich and beneficial for the audience and the church leaders that listen, counselors who may be listening, even kids and parents in foster and adoptive families that are listening. So thank you for taking the time with us today. As mentioned, Darby has recently released multiple publications, small and large. One particular, Something Scary Happened. Is that, am I saying it right? And
yeah,
I will hold up my little
Miles. It comes with a little sheep plushie.
Yeah. Yes, the audience doesn't get to see that, but I have Miles on my desk. Anyway, and also the mini book on trauma. You have two mini books on trauma, one for children, one for adults. What are the titles again?
When Children Experience Trauma. It's just really help for caregivers, just giving them some of those basics and those parenting struggles to help orient them to what's going on in their child. And yeah, to give them some strategies, but also some anchoring footholds for their journey. And the other one is trauma care. And that's just thinking about, before we do the deep trauma work, that safety and stability and trust and relationships have to be in place. So it's just, we want to be careful before we dive into the tenderness of people's story. And that mini book talks about that aspect.
Yeah. And I just have to say to you again, Darby, I can't say it enough. I love how you read scripture and then share it, because it's just so, it brings it to life in a very soft and ministering way. You're a good shepherd. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love that. Like, the children's book is Psalm 23, mm-hmm. right? And I just think that's what our children, and that's what we as parents, right, and caregivers and counselors know, that we all need that great shepherd.
Yeah. You
know? Thank you.
And I would say the children's book works for adults too.
Yes, it does.
I read it.
Me too.
A good children's book is helpful. I've used it in counseling settings with adults who I've said, like, this is what you should have known. Mm-hmm. Like, this is what should have been read to you in this, from this place of tenderness. Can you hear it now? Mm-hmm. And I think especially Miles' story has been really helpful for that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thank you for writing it, Darby.
Oh, my pleasure.
And Jill, putting yourself out there live on a podcast. Thank you. I look forward to your book that you don't know you're writing called Even Then. Watch for it.
I tell her that too.
Watch for it. Hello, PNR, New Growth. We've got a book here. Yeah, but just, I've been, Diane Langborg says this, I use it all the time about hearing a person's story and sitting in a sacred place. And that's what I've felt in just hearing you today and hearing it before, but especially hearing you say it live. I pray that God multiplies the impact of your story to the people who need it the most. So
thank you. It's I'm thankful for the place that he has brought me.
Mm-hmm. I am too. Yep. So that's all for today. If you want to learn more about becoming a licensed foster parent, please visit your local county's Department of Social Services website. If you want to know more about foster care, we suggest you start with some of the following resources. Foster the Family by Jamie Finn or Reframing Foster Care by Jason Johnson. If you're interested in learning more about trauma and building connection as a caretaker with a vulnerable child, we will include several resources in our show notes. And also we will include Darby's links for Darby's books as well. And if you're looking for a support group, a foster parent looking for a support group in your area, we'll include a link for that as well. Safe to Hope is a production of Help Her. Our executive producer is Anne-Marie Goudsward. Safe to Hope is written and mixed by Anne-Marie and edited by Anne-Marie and Helen Waite. Music is Waterfall and is licensed by Pixabay. We hope you enjoyed this episode in the Safe to Hope podcast series. Safe to Hope is one of the resources offered through the Ministry of Help Her, a 501c3 that provides training, resources, and the people necessary in order for the church to shepherd women well. Your donations make it possible for Help Her to serve women and churches as they navigate crises. All donations are tax deductible. If you'd be interested in partnering with this ministry, go to helpherresources.com and click the donate link in the menu. If you'd like more information or would like to speak to someone about ministry goals or advocacy needs, go to helpherresources.com. That's helpherresources.com.